Hello there. Today is Thursday, April 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democrats are expressing outrage over the U.S. Attorney General's comments about the Russia investigation.
I don't trust Barr. I trust Mueller.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to have won a fifth term. Also ahead, the first musician born in the 2000s to have a number one hit album. It's all on today's International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured a clear path to re-election for a fifth term Wednesday, with religious rightist parties set to hand him a parliamentary majority and his main challenger conceding defeat. With more than 99% of votes counted, ballots cast by military bases will be tallied over the next 2 days. Netanyahu's conservative Likud party looked likely to muster enough support to control 65 of the Knesset's 120 seats and be named to head the next coalition government. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was jubilant as he arrived at Likud party headquarters.
I am very grateful the people of Israel chose me for the fifth time with even more support.
For challenger Benny Gantz and his blue and white party, early hopes for victory disappeared Wednesday. Both parties received 35 seats in the 120-seat parliament, but the right-wing religious bloc, which supports Netanyahu, is much stronger than Gantz's center-left bloc. On the streets of Jerusalem, voting was brisk.
Rock Bibi!
Only Bibi. He does not discriminate against anyone, not Arabs, not Sephardim, not Ashkenazim. He says they are all people first. I love Bibi. He's the best.
I voted for blue and white, Kohol Lavan, because I think that Israel needs a change of leadership and some new politicians, and I think the country is so divided into extreme left and extreme right, and it's time to bring things back to the center.
I voted for Meretz, which is a left-wing party that has a loud, clear, humanistic message about preserving the democratic institutions of this country. And I very much want for Mr. Netanyahu to stop being the prime minister.
But that will not happen. Editor Liat Collins is with the International Jerusalem Post.
I think it's a vote of confidence in the sense of saying, we are in a relatively good place. The economy is in a relatively good situation diplomatically. We're not facing that tsunami that was predicted. And in that sense, I think it was a vote of confidence that Netanyahu can be happy with.
Jerusalem Report magazine editor Steve Lindy agrees the election was a confirmation of the political status quo.
In essence, it's a vote of confidence in Prime Minister Netanyahu and in his ability to continue leading this country for another few years at least. One never knows when the next election is going to be, but certainly he will probably head the 35th government and become the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history.
It now looks like Netanyahu's new Israeli government will not be very different from the previous one. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Tens of thousands of protesters have been gathered around Sudan's army headquarters since Saturday, demanding that President Omar al-Bashir be removed from power. At least 22 people have been killed in clashes with security forces, according to activists. Naba Mohideen has more from Khartoum.
Ahmed Al-Tayyib is a former lieutenant colonel in Sudan's army who resigned when President Omar al-Bashir came to power in 1989. 30 years later, he came to sit outside army headquarters with many retired ex-officers, chanting anti-Bashir slogans and voicing support for army troops who have defended protesters. He says that they support army troops and protesters' rights. They will not step back until we establish a great country. At least 22 people have been killed in clashes with security forces, according to activists. That include 5 soldiers killed after troops clashed with police trying to disperse the protesters. The head of the army's rapid support forces said in a televised speech Tuesday, the army will not break a peaceful protest. He said that his troops will never interfere in non-violent, constitutionally authorized protests since the first day. This is the Army First Lieutenant Ahmed Siddiq speaking to protesters on Tuesday, in the middle of chants and cheers. Siddiq said he's urging honorable soldiers in all army forces to stand by protesters. The demonstrations began in December to protest a steep hike in bread prices, but quickly changed into general protest against Bashir. The spokesman of Bashir's government, Hassan Ismail, told VOA that the only solution to Sudan's political crisis is dialogue. He said that ongoing sit-in was arranged by opposition group, which resist the dialogue. The Sudan sit-in has entered a new level. It's gone on for 5 nights, despite of the deadly first night. Observers say a military coup against Bashir is possible, but the international community is hoping that Bashir can be persuaded to step aside. On Tuesday, the United States, Britain, and Norway demanded Sudanese authorities deliver a credible plan for political transition. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump calls the Russia probe of the 26th campaign an attempted coup. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence urges the U.N. to recognize Venezuela's Guaido. The fight for Tripoli escalates as the U.N. prepares to meet. And the 2020 candidates are targeting college campuses and courting young voters. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Attorney General William Barr said on Wednesday that he would look into whether U.S. agencies illegally spied on President Trump's 2016 campaign, but acknowledged under sharp questioning by lawmakers that there was no evidence of wrongdoing. Barr, who was appointed by Trump, is already facing criticism by congressional Democrats for how he's handled the release of the special counsel Robert Mueller's report into the Russia probe and his comments that he's going to investigate whether the Trump campaign was spied upon during 2016.
I think there was spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
Well, let me...
The question is whether it was adequately predicated, and I'm not suggesting it wasn't adequately predicated, but I'd need to explore that. I think it's my obligation.
But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she is concerned by Barr's statements.
I do believe Special Counsel Mueller is a person to be respected. It remains to be seen what his report is. When we see it, we can make a judgment. I'm very concerned about the statements made by Attorney General Barr. I think that they undermine our Constitution, they undermine the role of the Attorney General. He is not the Attorney General of Donald Trump. He is the Attorney General of the United States.
Well, Barr's reference during a congressional hearing to spying in the early days of the federal Russia investigation echoed longstanding allegations by Trump and fellow Republicans that looked to cast doubt on the origins of the probe in an apparent attempt to discredit Mueller, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies. Joining us to discuss is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Do you think Barr should have used the word spying? He's gotten some criticism over that when it could very well have been legal surveillance.
Now, Mr. Barr may not be completely familiar with the terminology, but yes, absolutely. Now, if there is an allegation that the Democratic Party was actually conducting surveillance on its own, in other words, outside the legal system, then that is spying.
Well, the president, he made it very clear that he wanted an attorney general that protected him, and that's why he was so unhappy with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who recused himself from the Russia investigation. We know that Attorney General William Barr came in after writing a 19-page opinion to the president's lawyers in the Justice Department that basically discounting the entire Mueller report, and a lot of people would conclude that that's why he was hired for the job, to protect the president. But because of the fact that he seems to be really tight-lipped about what is in that report after all this time, including not willing to ask for the grand jury testimony to be released by the judges, which apparently in the past has always happened. Lots of redactions, even to Congress, that is used to getting intelligence reports all the time, classified information.
It is not true that routinely grand jury reports are released. That's just not true. It does happen. There is a federal rule of criminal procedure that prohibits it. So it seems to me that Mr. Barr is following the law here. What he ends up deciding to do with respect to limiting grand jury materials that go to the Hill, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But it is very strong rule that you don't release grand jury materials to the public.
That's not what Congress was asking for. They were asking for the grand jury information confidentially for their own investigations.
That doesn't change anything. The Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure 6E talks about release, and it doesn't specify to the press versus Capitol Hill.
He also said that when asked about Mueller, if Mueller had given him, advised him at all as to whether or not he felt it would be okay on regard to the grand jury, in regard to, you know, any of these issues, and he didn't consult Mueller.
Nor should he. He is the attorney general. I assume he consulted perhaps with a deputy or perhaps some of his close advisors at DOJ, but there's no particular reason why he should have consulted Mueller.
He was hired as a neutral party to make a recommendation.
Yes.
And when it comes to the issue of obstruction, he could not clear the president, so Barr did. Congress says they were the ones that should have made it, the decision.
Congress is not part of the executive branch. The Constitution puts that responsibility in Article 2, the executive branch.
Do you think Congress should, as they've requested, see the entire Mueller report without redactions, not the public, but Congress itself?
If you're referring to redactions having to do with grand jury materials, my answer is no. Now, there may be other redactions based on, for example, national security secrets and stuff like that. Then some members of Congress certainly ought to be able to see it, since they are privy to much, not all, but much of the nation's intelligence materials.
How much do you think the public will find out? Do you think that they will get enough information when Mr. Barr does finally release it, the report publicly, that they will feel satisfied that they understand what transpired, how they came to conclusions that they did?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, Bill Barr is a very smart person. He's going to know that a lot of people, a lot of very smart people, are going to be looking at what is released. And I think that he will provide enough materials that, perhaps not rabid partisans, but most others will say, I understand what went on. I understand the report. Yeah, I understand why the president was not viewed as being as interfering with the investigation.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. With a Friday deadline looming for the UK to leave the European Union, leaders of the 27 countries in the EU and British Prime Minister Theresa May agreed on Wednesday to extend Britain's date of departure from the bloc until October 31st. European Union Council President Donald Tusk told Britain Thursday not to waste the extra time to sort out Brexit.
This extension is as flexible as I expected and a little bit shorter than I expected, but it's still enough to find the best possible solution. Please do not waste this time.
Ahead of the decision, May had been meeting other EU leaders to make her case for extension. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field has more from Paris.
Prime Minister Theresa May went on a whirlwind tour of the two most important countries in the European Union, Germany and France. She had lunch on Tuesday with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, at which she asked her if she could do anything to help to postpone that date that Britain has to leave the European Union. And she said very clearly that she was still trying to get this withdrawal agreement through Parliament, that it was difficult for the UK, but she needed to get a postponement of a departure until June 30th. Now, she got a bit of a hearing from Angela Merkel, but not probably as much as she wanted. Angela Merkel agreed, yes, she would do what she could to help. Theresa May then jumped on a plane and flew here to Paris, where she met the French president, Emmanuel Macron. Now, Emmanuel Macron was a bit tougher. Emmanuel Macron was still unsure whether he's playing a good cop, bad cop, but he said that he wouldn't be against a shortish extension, but wouldn't be happy with a lengthy extension. Now, what Emmanuel Macron wants, and he made it very clear to her, is she's got to put something on the table. She's got to say what she's doing to make sure that the United Kingdom sets itself up to be able to leave the European Union in an orderly fashion that doesn't disrupt all the economies of the European Union. So that was what she was doing Tuesday, Wednesday night in Brussels. All the leaders of the European Union get together. 28 heads of government decide the United Kingdom can have that extension. The summit conclusion says that they would like the United Kingdom to have a brief delay or a brief postponement. This draft summit communique says that there's no point in having the sort of short extensions and emergency summits and new cliff edge deals. This just isn't any way for any of the economies to get together. So what they're going to try and do as well is, if you like, curb their powers while they're still there. So that would mean having no right to vote on, well, for example, the budget for the European Union, perhaps not being able to vote for the new president of the European Commission and the new president for the European Council, these key top posts in the European Union. So they may also decide that those are the sort of key matters that, even if the United Kingdom stays in the European Union, they won't be able to have a say in that.
So far, Theresa May has really not fulfilled the things that she was elected to do. So how will she bode in all of this? What does her future look like?
Well, her future at the moment, it looks very slim. I mean, first of all, she looks very weak, and members of her own party have been criticizing her for this, what they've called this humiliating begging tour that she's been on across Europe today. So she's come out of it looking very weak, because she has been saying Brexit means Brexit. I'm going to take the United Kingdom out of the European Union. And she hasn't been able to do that. Plus, these cross-party talks that she's been saying are going to be the key for getting the UK out of the European Union, well, they've now broken down. No one's sure about where they're going to go. So reaching out to the Labour Party hasn't worked. Plus, she's going to have to go to this summit, and they're going to offer her a much longer extension than she wanted. And they're going to insist that her party actually field candidates for the European parliamentary elections in May. So she looks very weak. She's had to go back on all this. And the ultimate humiliation of having promised her electorate she would bring them out of the European Union. In fact, she's now got to turn around and explain to the electorate why they're going to all have to vote for parliamentarians for the European Parliament.
That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Thank you so much. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. An international team of scientists gathered around the world Wednesday to simultaneously reveal the first ever picture of a black hole, celestial body considered so dense even light itself cannot escape its gravitational pull. Scientists have been monitoring what black holes do to the space around them for decades. Their immense gravity warps time and space in a way that Albert Einstein predicted and that researchers can see. But they've never seen a black hole until now. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
It wasn't easy, Researchers spent 10 years linking up 8 different telescopes around the world. Then, 2 years ago, using super-exact atomic clocks, each telescope pointed itself at a galaxy called M87, 55 million light-years away. After sifting through mountains of data and making sure of their results, scientists from the Event Horizon Telescope Project today released the first-ever photograph of a black hole.
In April of 2017, all the dishes in the Event Horizon Telescope swiveled, turned, and stared at a galaxy 55 million light-years away. It's called Messier 87, or M87. And there's a supermassive black hole at its core. And we are delighted to be able to report to you today that we have seen what we thought was unseeable. We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole. Here it is.
It's not much to look at, a shiny yellow-orange donut floating in space, but it's exactly what scientists have always believed a black hole should look like. There's a central area of darkness where gravity is so strong not even light can escape its pull. Surrounding that, an area of gas and dust, superheated to billions of degrees centigrade, and then blown out into space at nearly the speed of light.
Black holes are thought to evolve at the end of a lifetime of a star. And you can think of a star collapsing in on itself to make a super, super dense object. In the case of our own galaxy, we know that there's a black hole, a supermassive black hole lurking in its heart. It's about as big as the orbit of Mercury. It's a few million times the mass of our own sun. And we now think that these supermassive black holes lurk at the heart of every galaxy.
And they are incredibly powerful. Those jets of gas can reach millions of light years into space. And the gravity is so powerful it can warp the light from even massive suns that come close enough to them. The researchers today say this photograph points the way for new and better ways to study black holes.
And this image forges a clear link now between supermassive black holes and the engines of bright galaxies. We now know clearly that black holes drive large-scale structure in the universe from their home in these galaxies. And we now have an entirely new way of studying general relativity in black holes that we never had before. And as with all great discoveries, this is just the beginning.
The researchers are looking forward to getting more pictures and even expanding the size of their telescopes by using space-based observatories to get clearer images of these mysterious objects. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, a group of scientists is using technology used to study the stars in order to find endangered orangutans in the dense forests of Indonesia. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the heat-seeking drones are helping scientists keep track of the number of the endangered great apes.
According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the number of Bornean orangutans has dropped by nearly two-thirds since the 1970s. Tracking the endangered animals can prove difficult since they build their nests in trees. The traditional method for counting them has been to count the nests from the ground, but the dense jungle foliage means that method is unreliable. Now, thanks to a collaboration between Liverpool's John Moores University, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and the Hutan Conservation Project, scientists are using a new tool to find the great apes, drones. These drones are equipped with thermal imaging cameras that are usually used for studying the luminosity of stars. Dr. Serge Witch of Liverpool John Moores University is an expert on primate behavioral ecology. He says he was skeptical that the drones would be able to detect the body heat signatures of orangs in the trees.
We've been extremely successful with detecting the orangutans in their nests from various heights. So we've learned a lot by those results. We found out, for instance, that even when orangutans are covered by a certain amount of vegetation, we can still pick up their signal, so we don't need nests that are completely open. So that makes it very promising, because orangutans not always make their nests very high up in the canopy. Sometimes it's covered by leaves.
The team made a total of 28 flights at two sites over 6 days and spotted 41 orangutans from the air. All of the observations were confirmed by scientists on the ground. Serge Witch says the flights were done early in the morning or after sundown in order to get the best results.
We've been working predominantly when it's dark, so early mornings and early evenings. And we do that because if it's during the day, the temperature of the forest is quite similar to the temperatures of the bodies of mammals, so you can't detect warm-blooded animals that well. During the evening, the forest cools down and detection, the heat difference becomes larger, so detection goes up. In the morning, it's best because the forest had all night to cool down, lose its heat, and then the animals really stand out and you can detect them very, very well.
The team also spotted a troop of proboscis monkeys during the field trial, which they distinguished from the orangs because of their smaller size. Pygmy elephants were also captured during a nighttime forage through an oil palm plantation. The researchers are now developing an algorithm in order to tell animal species apart. Borneo's orangutans have been critically endangered since 2016. Their numbers have dropped dramatically since the 1970s, when large portions of their habitat were destroyed and replaced by oil palm plantations. The World Wildlife Federation says that there were more than 230,000 orangutans in total a century ago. However, the WWF says the Bornean orangutan is now estimated at about 104,700 based on updated geographic range. The Sumatran orang has about 7,500 animals. A new species of orangutan announced in 2017, the Tanapuli orangutan. A new species of orang announced in 2017, the Tanapuli orangutan, has only 800 known animals. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
A Los Angeles pop singer-songwriter has broken a record for the first artist born in the 2000s to have a number one album. 17-year-old pop star Billie Eilish's debut album, When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, also makes her the youngest woman to take the number one spot since Demi Lovato released her album Here We Go Again when she was just 16. In 2018, Eilish revealed that she suffers from Tourette's syndrome, and she talked about it with comedian Ellen DeGeneres on her talk show.
You spoke about something that I think is really important and brave that you didn't intend to speak about, but that you have Tourette's syndrome and that it comes out at certain times. But I think that's amazing that you spoke about it, because you kind of take away the, you know, scariness of it.
It's something I've lived with my whole life, and everybody knows, like everybody in my family, all my friends, all the people that are closest to me know I have it, and it's not anything different, you know? And I just never said anything because I didn't want that to define who I was. I didn't want it to be like Billie, the artist with Tourette's.
In 2016, Eilish released her debut single, Ocean Eyes, which subsequently went viral. Eilish has 7 gold and 2 platinum singles. Friends with time, he left her lonely with the diamond mine. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. I'm never
This is VOA News. I'm